And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April the 1st. April Fool's Day. 91st day of the year. 274 days remain till the year's over with. Holidays and observances. We have White House Easter egg roll, though His Lordship has forbidden any religious markings. It's Easter Monday. Take down tobacco, National Day of Action. Harmonize Your Health Day. National Greeting Card Day. And a National Fun at Work Day. And as I said, it's April Fool's Day. Reading is Funny Day. National Sourdough Bread Day. Fun Day. National 1 Cent Day. Can't get much for 1 cent. Community Garden Week. Edinburgh Science Festival. FOP Awareness Month. Ramadan is still going on until April 8th. March Madness, National Public Health Week. Famous people born on this date, Logan Paul, Rachel Maddow. She was vaccinated with a phonograph needle, apparently. Mackenzie Davis, Randy Orton, professional wrestler, Taryn Killam, and Bijou Phillips. April is also International Guitar Month. Step Up for 30 for Bowel Cancer Month. Scottish American Heritage Month, Global Volunteer Month, National Alcohol Awareness Month, National Soy Foods Month, National Food Month, National Month of Hope, National Salt Pretzel Month, Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, National Volunteer Month, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, National Kite Month, National Garden Month, National Poetry Month, Autism Acceptance Month, National Pickleball Month, Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month, Stress Awareness Month, National Jazz Appreciation Month, Poetic Earth Month, National Couple Appreciation Month, Adopt a Ferret Month. There's a lot of orphan ferrets out there, so go ahead and adopt one. Straw Hat Month, Month of the Military Child, Active Dog Month, Summer Tire Changeover Month, National Decorating Month, and Parkinson's Awareness Month. All that having been said, 527, Byzantine Emperor Justin I names his nephew Justinian I as co-ruler and successor to the throne. You know, the Byzantine Empire was the Eastern Roman Empire originally, when the Roman Empire became so big it had to be divided into two. 1084 in 81, Alexios I Komnenos overthrows the Byzantine Emperor Nikephoros III Botanilides, and after his troops spent 3 days extensively looting Constantinople, formally crowned April 4th. 1572, in the 80 Years' War, the writer Guzin captured Brielle from the 17 provinces, gaining the first foothold on land for what would become the Dutch Republic. 1789, New York City, the U.S. House of Representatives, achieves its first quorum and elects Frederick Muhlenberg of Pennsylvania as its first speaker. 1833, you don't have to be a member of the House to be the speaker. Anybody can be the speaker of the House. 1833, the Convention of 1833, a political gathering of settlers in Mexican Texas to help draft a series of petitions to the Mexican government, begins in San Felipe de Austin. 1865, American Civil War. Union troops led by Phil Sheridan decisively defeat Confederate troops led by George Pickett, cutting the Army of Northern Virginia's last supply line during the Siege of Petersburg. 1867, Singapore becomes a British Crown Colony. 1873, the White Star steamer SS Atlantic sinks off Nova Scotia, kills 547 people, one of the worst marine disasters in the 19th century. 1900, Prince George becomes absolute monarch of the Cretan state. 1908, the Territorial Police, renamed the Territorial Army in 1920, is formed as a voluntary reserve component of the British Army. 1918, the Royal Air Force is created by the merging of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service. 1922, in newly formed Northern Ireland, six Catholics are murdered in the Arnon Street killings, 1 week after six others are killed in the McMahon killings. 1924, Adolf Hitler is sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for his participation in the Beer Hall Putsch, but spends only 9 months in jail. 1924, the Royal Canadian Air Force is formed. On this day in 1933, the recently elected Nazis under Julius Streicher organize a one-day boycott of all his Jewish-owned businesses in Germany. That ushered in a series of anti-Semitic acts. 1935, the India's Central Banking Institution, the Reserve Bank of India, is formed. 1937, Aden becomes a British Crown Colony. Also in 1937, the Royal New Zealand Air Force is formed as an independent service. 1939, Spanish Civil War. Generalissimo Francisco Franco of the Spanish state announces the end of the Spanish Civil War with the last of the Republican forces surrender. 1941, Fontana Alba Massacre. Between the 200 and 2,000 Romanian civilians are killed by Soviet border troops. The took place in northern Bukovina. Up to 3,000 civilians are killed in their attempt to cross the border from the Soviet Union to Romania near the village of Fontana Alba. This attempt was met with open fire by the Soviet border troops. According to Soviet official reports, no more than 44 civilians were killed. Local witnesses said it was much higher, stating the survivors were tortured, killed, or buried in mass graves. The survivors were taken away to be tortured and killed at the hands of the NKVD. That was the Soviet secret police. Some sources refer to this massacre as the Romanian Katyn. 2011, the Chamber of Deputies of Romania adopted a law establishing April 1st as a national day honoring the memory of Romanian victims of massacres at Fontana Alba, Lunca, and other areas, of deportations, of hunger, and other forms of repression organized by the Soviet regime in Herceg, northern Bukovina, and Bessarabia. 1941, military coup in Iraq overthrows the regime of Abd al-Allah and installs Rashid Ali al-Gaylani as prime minister. 1944, World War II. Navigation errors lead to the accidental American bombing of the Swiss city of Schaffhausen. 1945, World War II. 10th U.S. Army attacks the 32nd Japanese Army on Okinawa. 1946, an 8.6 magnitude Aleutian Islands earthquake shakes the Aleutian Islands with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 6, which is considered strong. A destructive tsunami reaches Hawaiian Islands, resulting in dozens of deaths, mostly in Hilo, Hawaii. 1946, the Malayan Union is established. Protests from locals led to the establishment of the Federation of Malaya 2 years later. 1947, the only mutiny in the history of the Royal New Zealand Navy begins on this date. 1948, Cold War. Communist forces respond to the introduction of the Deutschmark by attempting to force the Western powers to withdraw from Berlin. 1948, Faroe Islands gain autonomy from Denmark. 1949, Chinese Civil War. Chinese Communist Party holds unsuccessful peace talks with the Nationalist Party in Beijing after 3 years of fighting. Also in 1949, the government of Canada repeals Japanese-Canadian internment after 7 years. 1954, U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower authorizes the creation of the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. 1955, the EOKA rebellion against the British Empire begins in Cyprus with the goal of unifying with Greece. The ELKA is a national organization of Cypriot fighters. It was a Greek Cypriot nationalist guerrilla organization that fought a campaign for the end of British rule in Cyprus and for them to join up with Greece. All right, let's see what else we got. 1960, the Tyros 1 satellite transmits the first television pictures of from space. 1964, the British Admiralty War Office and Air Ministry are replaced by the Unified Defense Council of the United Kingdom. 1969, the Hawker Siddeley Harrier, the first operational fighter aircraft with vertical short takeoff and landing capabilities, enters service with the Royal Air Force. 1970, President Richard Nixon signs the Public Health Cigarette Smoking Act into law. Also in 1970, a Royal Air Maroc Sud Aviation Caravelle crashes near Berrachid, Morocco, killing 61 people. 1971, Bangladesh Liberation War. Pakistan Army massacre more than 1,000 people in Karanganji, Upazila in Bangladesh. 1973, Project Tiger, Tiger Conservation Project, is launched in the Jim Corbett National Park in India. 1974, the Local Government Act of 1972 of England and Wales comes into effect. 1976, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak found Apple Computer. I listened to Wozniak talk at the National Association of Broadcasters a few years ago. Tells a good story. 1979, Iran becomes an Islamic Republic by 99% vote, officially overthrowing the Shah. 1984, singer Marvin Gaye shot to death by his father in his home in Arlington Heights, Los Angeles. 1986, Communist Party of Nepal cadres attack a number of police stations in Kathmandu, seeking to incite a popular rebellion. 1989, Margaret Thatcher's new local government tax, the community charge, commonly known as the poll tax, is introduced in Scotland. Yes, you have to pay a fee to vote, folks. 1993, NASCAR racer Alan Kozwicki is killed in a plane crash near the Tri-Cities Regional Airport in Blountville, Tennessee. 1997, the comet Hale-Bopp is seen passing at perihelion. 1999, Nunavut is established as a Canadian territory carved out of the eastern part of the Northwest Territory. 2001, an EP-3E, United States Navy surveillance aircraft, collides with a Chinese People's Liberation Army Shenyang J-8 fighter jet. Chinese pilot ejected but is subsequently lost. The Navy crew makes an emergency landing in Hainan, China, is detained. 2001, former president of Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic, surrenders to police special forces to be tried on war crimes charges. 2001, same-sex marriage becomes legal in the Netherlands, the first contemporary country to allow it. 2004, Google launches its email service, Gmail. 2006, Serious Organized Crime Agency, the SOCA, the government of the UK, is enforced, but it later merged into the National Crime Agency on October 7, 2013. 2011, after protests against the burning of the Quran turned violent, a mob attacks a United Nations compound in Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan. Results in the death of 13 people, including 8 foreign workers. 2016, Nagorno-Karabakh conflict begins along the Nagorno-Karabakh line of contact. Well, there's always going to be a reason to fight. Quite often it's based on religion, which is, in my humble opinion, a silly reason to take life. Now, all that having been said about our little history segment, we're going to be talking about something I've heard called urban exploring. Okay, my system shut down for a minute, and I wasn't aware of it. Well, we've got, we were talking, and I don't know what was recording, what wasn't, about St. Elmo. Born during the gold rush and died when the rush ended. He's in Chaffee County, Colorado. Founded in 1880. Abandoned in 1952. It was originally called Forest City. U.S. Post Office objected because there were too many forest cities to keep straight. So the one of the city's founders, Griffin Evans, was reading the Augusta Jane Evans novel, St. Elmo, at the time. Decided that'd be a perfect name, and it stuck. Well, for years, it thrived, thanks to nearby gold, silver, and copper and iron mines. And after the railroad came through in 1881, it grew even faster. And then when the Alpine Tunnel, one of the highest railroad tunnels in North America, was built, to connect it to towns on the western side of the Continental Divide, it really boomed. Had restaurants and town halls and plenty of saloons. And on Saturday night, everybody's ready to party downtown. At one point, it had a population of over 2,000, which was, for that time period, quite a large population. But the beginning of the end came in 1890 when a fire destroyed the business section of downtown. Never completely rebuilt. Between the fire and rapid depletion of the mines, residents began to leave. After the Alpine Tunnel was closed in 1910, the families that stayed in St. Elmo started to leave as well. Well, trains continued to stop there until 1922, and when they quit coming, the town essentially ceased to exist. There was an attempt to spark a revival. Roy and Tony Stark, descendants of one of St. Elmo's most elite famous families, spent years searching for somebody to come in and reopen the mines. Apparently, there's still wealth to be taken out of the ground there. But when they couldn't get any takers, they became tourism brokers, leasing the empty buildings and to vacationing families and continuing to operate the general store. By 1934, Tony and his sister Annabelle Stark were the only two residents left in St. Elmo. To visitors, Annabelle became known as Dirty Annie. She appeared disheveled and roaming the town with ragged clothes, carrying a rifle for her protection and to protect her town. Two eventually ended up in a mental health facility shortly after the town's official death in 1952. It was an occasion marked by the closing of the post office. Remarkably, relatives of the Starks continued to live in the town for a number of years after that. And Annie's ghost is still reported. She still patrols the streets, according to local legend. Well, today, St. Elmo stands as one of the most well-preserved ghost towns in the U.S., 2002, a fire destroyed several structures, including the town hall, but the general store, the church, the school, and a lot of private cabins still remain. These relics are surrounded by hiking and horse and ATV trails, which are used by a constant stream of visitors who come to look for what's left of the boomtown and find the ghost of Dirty Annie. And we got Rhyolite, Nevada. Town that collapsed nearly as fast as it rose. Located in Nye County, Nevada. It was founded in 1904, abandoned in 1916. It emerged out of nowhere in 1904 when two prospectors, Frank Shorty Harris and E.L. Cross, found rich deposits of quartz and gold in the Bullfrog Hills. That's Bullfrog Hills is about 120 miles northwest of Las Vegas. At that point in time, only one person lived in the region. But, of course, with the finding of gold, that was going to change. Not long after they made their discovery, avaricious prospectors laid out more than 2,000 claims within a 30-mile area. Town sprang up near the camps, named Rhyolite, after the pink gray volcanic rock that we found everywhere. Buildings and mine popped up as well. Man, the money started to flow. Biggest excavation, the Montgomery Shoshone Mine, was bought in 1906 by Charles Schwab, who invested heavily in the town's infrastructure. To help his mine and the surrounding area, he outfitted Rhyolite with water mains, electric lights, concrete sidewalks, newspapers, and telephone lines, and he did it all within the space of a year. town built schools and hospitals and opera house, the stock exchange, as the population grew to over 4,000 people by 1907. It all ended in a flash with the panic of 1907, the first worldwide financial crisis of the 20th century, and it hit Rowlett hard. Within a few years, the mines began to close and the banks began to fail and local businesses started to shut their doors. By 1910, production at even the biggest mills had slowed so much the town's population had dwindled down to fewer than 700 people. Then on March 14, 1911, a Montgomery Shoshone mine shut down. Remains of the town lasted for another 5 years. But by 1916, the lights and electricity had been shut off for good. Today, Rowlett's run by the Bureau of Land Management is considered to be one of the most photographed ghost towns in the world. A lot of structures still stand, and a number have been restored, including the famous Bottle House, which was built in 1906 out of old glass bottles by a miner named Tom Kelly. The town has also been used as a setting for Hollywood movies, including The Reward in 1965 and The Island in 2005. All that's left of Rowlett today is about 5 blocks worth of partial and complete structures with a modern art museum that's located just outside of town. Not exactly a bustling community these days. Well, let's talk about a town that once boasted one of the richest gold strikes in the Rocky Mountains, which was discovered at the height of the Civil War. I'm talking about Virginia City, Montana. Located in Madison County, Montana, found in 1863, abandoned in 1875. You know, the combination of the sudden influx of money and the animosity between North and South turned into one of the most dangerous places in the country. Virginia City, Montana, that is. Truly, it was the Wild, Wild West. All started in 1863 when prospectors Bill Fairweather and Henry Edgar discovered gold near Alder Gulch. Now, they weren't able to keep their discovery a secret and eventually followed to the site by hundreds of other fortune seekers. Now, Virginia City was deep in Union territory, but these rivals mostly came from the South. A situation that gave rise to a lot of tension. To honor their Southern heritage, new residents wanted to name the boomtown after Verena Howell Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis and First Lady of the Confederacy. When they registered the name, a judge in Connecticut objected and designated that the new town's name would be Virginia City. Despite these issues, the place boomed. Millions of dollars worth of gold was discovered, and nearly 10,000 people settled in the area. But since Virginia City is located in a remote section of the Idaho Territory, the town had no formal law enforcement or justice system. It was monitored only by what we call miners' courts, and that led to a lot of crime and an alarming number of murders. Infamous Montana vigilantes began policing the city and hanging captured criminals. That saved on the cost of trials. Well, when the U.S. government officially incorporated the Montana Territory in 1864, Virginia City became its first capital. But by that point in time, the inevitable decline of the place had already started. When gold was discovered in Last Chance Gulch and Helena, many residents of Virginia City relocated there. By 1870, only a few hundred people still lived in the former boomtown, and in 1875, Helena was named the new capital of the territory. Even Henry Edgar knew Virginia City's demise was inevitable, and that's why he began working with the Montana Historical Society to preserve what was left in 1899. And thanks to his efforts and the money of Charles and Sue Bovee, who bought and restored the town in the 1940s, Virginia City is considered a well-preserved ghost town, operated as an open-air museum with about 237 structures and signs placed all around that tell visitors about the history of the place. 1961, it was designated a National Historic Landmark. See, the point I want to make is that if you're an urban explorer, there are plenty of places to explore. A lot of folks like to go into, even breaking into, to old buildings in some of the less populated towns. And that does have its dangers. Well, let's go to Nevada City, Montana. Located in Madison County, Montana. It was founded in 1863 and abandoned in 1876. It was established in what would become the Montana Territory and wasn't nearly as famous or as perhaps we should say infamous as its neighbor Virginia City. But since it's just 1.5 miles to the west, it shares parts of the same history, including being born out of the gold discovery at Alder Gulch in 1863. After prospectors Bill Fairweather and Henry Edgar established their claim, other miners began to flock to the area, settled in a number of camps, and blossomed into towns, including Summit and Adobe Town and Central City and Junction and Nevada City. These sprang up along a stretch of Alder Gulch, and together they're known as the 14-Mile City. After the region became known for its lawlessness, Nevada City was the site of one of the most famous miners' court trials of the day. It involved a man named George Ives, who was a road agent, a criminal gang member who murdered a popular Dutchman named Nicholas Tablat and stole his gold. Ives was then hunted down by a group of men that became known as the Montana Vigilantes. His trial lasted 3 days and was attended by 2,000 people. Well, he was found guilty, and just 58 minutes after the return of the guilty verdict, he was hung. Well, Nevada City never grew as big as its neighbor, but its fall was equally as fast. By 1869, just 6 years after it was founded, its population had fallen to about 100 people. Even though it still had 3 general stores, 2 saloons, and several local businesses running. Miners kept leaving for better opportunities, and eventually by 1876, everybody was gone. 1896, the Conry Placer Mining Company began a 24-year project to dredge the gulch. And Conry extracted nearly $10 million in gold, but in the process destroyed most of what was left of Nevada City's buildings. Today, only 14 original buildings remain, although the town actually has more than 100, most of which have been imported or built to represent the rich history of the region. Much of the financing came from Charles and Sue Bovey, heirs to the General Mills fortune, who also invested heavily in the restoration nearby Virginia City. Now operated by the Montana Heritage Commission, Nevada City is an outdoor history museum and a popular tourist stop in the region. They even have a sign commemorating the tree where George Ives was hung December 21st, 1863. Well, let's go back to Connecticut, Dudley Town, located in the northwest corner. It isn't actually a town, it's a section of the nearby village of Cornwall. It's founded in 1738. It's in Litchfield County, abandoned in 1900. And it's first known as Owlsbury when it was settled by farmers in 1738. And that made sense since the area, a valley known as the Dark Entry Forest, was home to a lot of owls. Nobody's actually sure when he got the name Dudley Town, but it was sometime after Abiel and Barzilia Dudley arrived in 1747. And later on, they were joined by 3 more men believed to be Abiel's brothers. The area eventually filled with more Dudleys, but it was believed the family was cursed. Legend dates back to 16th century England. Edmund Dudley had his head chopped off for annoying the royal court of King Henry VII. About 50 years later, his son, John Dudley, the Duke of Northumberland, tried to overthrow King Edward VI by having his son, Lord Guilford Dudley, marry Lady Jane Grey. Well, when the marriage proceeded and Jane became queen, the plot failed and these 2 Dudleys were decapitated. Eventually, Lady Grey was executed. And her ghost is said to still be wandering the tower. True believers are convinced the Dudleys brought their misfortune to Connecticut, as evidenced by a series of murders and suicides and untimely deaths and other residents simply losing their minds, most of which seemed to begin in the late 1700s, not long after the Dudleys arrived. Eventually, Dudley Town failed entirely, and this was mostly due to the area's poor conditions for farming, though some believe it was the work of the Dudley curse. So much so that ghost hunters, thrill seekers, and curious tourists flocked to the area to see for themselves. And that caused a major problem for the area residents. According to Dudley Town resident John Leach, in an article in the New York Times in 1989, he said they come roaring up here expecting there to be toilet facilities and concession stands. What they don't realize is absolutely nothing here to be seen. And that's mostly true. Remains of the town are few and tourists are no longer welcome. Land was put into private trust in the 1920s and visitors have been banned since the 1980s. What's left is dark and creepy and rarely seen by outsiders. Area's been reforested, so most of the roads are gone. Few people try to visit it anyway, but the police are usually quick to respond. As a result, even photographs of modern Dudley Town are rare. Of course, it would be interesting to check it out. Well, let's go to Maryland. Glendale Hospital. When it was first built, it was a tuberculosis sanitarium, built in 1934. It was a beautiful campus of 23 buildings constructed among rolling grassy hills. It's in Glendale, Maryland, founded in 1934 and abandoned in 1982. Now, the facility was large, comfortable, and featured lots of outdoor spaces. It was believed that vitamin D and sunshine were effective treatments for tuberculosis. Hospital quickly became one of the most important health facilities in the Washington, D.C. area. But once a tuberculosis vaccine was discovered in the 1940s, cases declined rapidly, and this forced Glendale to begin treating other conditions. Eventually, it became a nursing home. Well, it was finally closed and abandoned in 1982, mostly because it was full of asbestos, which gave rise to a legend that it was once used as a prison and a hospital for the criminally insane. Because the comment was made, you had to be crazy to go there. Well, part of that mythology is owed to the stigma around tuberculosis, which is known as the White Plague well into the 1930s and 40s. Those days, people were afraid of tuberculosis because they didn't know much about it. Kara Com Lewis, a spokeswoman for the Maryland Prince George County Department of Parks and Recreation, said the patients diagnosed with tuberculosis were cast off from society. Their families wouldn't tell people where their relatives had vanished to. It was an embarrassment. That kept the hospital somewhat out of view. Rather than seeing it as a place of healing, people feared it and its inhabitants. And the stigma stuck until Glendale's closing and continued to grow over the last 40 years as its abandoned buildings began to crumble. Today it remains a haven for teenagers looking for a thrill as well as ghost hunters of all ages. Hospital grounds are popular to visitors around Halloween especially. Campus belongs to the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, but shortly after it was acquired, in 1994, the District of Columbia passed a law saying that if Glendale is ever sold, it must be used as a continuing care or retirement community. And because of that, several attempts to sell the property have fallen through. Glendale was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2011, but it's in a state of disrepair. Upper floors of many of the buildings have caved in, and several are covered with graffiti on the outside. Many of the windows and doors are broken out, and the insides are still filled with asbestos. In fact, the only thing occupying Glendale Hospital today are legends of hauntings and of mysterious figures appearing in the windows, as well as reports of unexplained bangs and screams. Well, we've also got Cahaba. That's in Alabama, don't you know? It's in Dallas County, to be exact. Found in 1818, abandoned in 1900. It's a ghost town. It was built on top of a ghost town. Not a great way to begin, frankly. But the idea of Cahaba seemed a good one in 1818 when Alabama was searching for a location for its state capital. Picturesque site on the banks of both the Alabama and the Cahaba Rivers was right in the center of the state. What planters soon learned, though, was that in the confluence of the two rivers brought a lot of trouble. An odor in the air bothered residents, and mosquitoes swarmed the town. It sparked a fear of outbreaks of malaria and yellow fever and all sorts of diseases, and The seasonal flooding only made it get worse. As the Alabama Historical Society found years later, the surveyors of the site knew they were building the capitol on the remains of an old ghost town. It's believed to be a town named Villa, Native American village destroyed by Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto in 1540. State house even supposed to sit on the ancient Indian mound, a place used for religious rituals, which may explain some of the confusion that seems to emanate from Alabama. Cahaba only served as a state capital from 1820 to 1825 before it was moved about 90 miles away to Tuscaloosa. The town survived in the antebellum years on the backs of the largely enslaved African-American population and revenues from the lucrative cotton trade. Huge cotton distribution center, the town grew into one of the wealthier places in the region once the railroad was connected in 1859. By 1860, Cahaba had 2,000 residents, though nearly two-thirds of them were enslaved. During the Civil War, the Confederate government took over, seizing the railroad and some of the property. Even turned a large cotton warehouse into a military prison at one point, and it held 3,000 captured Union soldiers for some time. 1865, a major flood forced the Confederate government to move the prison. State legislature moved the Dallas County seat to nearby Selma. Soon, residents and businesses followed suit, and by 1870, most of the people were gone. After the Civil War, the town did briefly become a haven for the formerly enslaved who were trying to organize politically and redevelop the vacant plots in town. Wasn't long before they moved away, too. By the late 1800s, most of the old town site was bought by a freedman, person released from from slavery, for the sum of $500. He had most of the town torn down so he could sell the building material. Only a few structures survive today in Old Cahaba Archaeological Park. It's on the National Register of Historic Places, but consists mostly of abandoned streets, cemeteries, and building shells. And, of course, there are the ghosts, or at least one, the ghost of Confederate Colonel C.C. Pugues. Reportedly appears as a white orb over the garden maze of his own property. Others believe it's a ghost of a dead Civil War soldier or one of the many residents who died in the seasonal floods. Well, let's talk about Kennecott, Alaska. For a short time, this town was home to one of the most lucrative copper mines in the world. But even that couldn't survive the Great Depression. It's in Copper River Census Area in Alaska, abandoned in 1838. It was born in a boom town in the summer of 1900 after prospectors Tarantula Jack Smith and Clarence Warner saw the unmistakable green markings of copper deposits in the mountains surrounding the Kennecott Glacier. And other discoveries followed shortly after that. 1903, the Kennecott Mining Corporation was born. Located 300 miles east of Anchorage, Kennecott was home to five active mines during the early years of the 20th century. In the 30 years they were running, the mine produced an estimated 4.6 tons of ore, valued by some at more than $200 million. Kennecott Copper Corporation became one of the largest mineral companies in the world. It had no trouble luring workers to the isolated settlement because it was able to offer higher salaries than any mining company in the country. Though most of its residents were transient workers who sent their money home, the picturesque town nevertheless became a thriving hamlet. Miners in Kennecott worked grueling seven-day weeks, and the company showed movies and held dances at the recreation hall to keep its employees happy during the long, dark nights of the Alaskan winter. But, as has been observed more than once, nothing lasts forever. 1925, a geologist predicted that the five mines, the Bonanza, the Jumbo, the Mother Lode, the Erie, and the Glacier would soon be mined out. At least mined out of high-grade ore, that is. And it turns out he was right. Most of the high-grade ore was gone by the late 1920s and early 1930s. And about that same time, the Great Depression hit and the price of copper dropped. Soon the mines began to close down. The Glacier Mine went first in 29. The other four held on for a time before then finally shutting down in 1938. And with businesses shuttering and workers leaving, the last train left Kennecott November 10, 1938. What was left behind has since been preserved by the National Park Service and become a popular tourist attraction. Several of the buildings, including the Kennecott Recreation Hall, have been restored, and a number of other restorations are in progress. And the most famous structure of all still stands, the massive red concentration mill that sits silently brooding over all 14 stories above the Kennecott Glacier. Well, let's talk about, go back to Montana again. This time it's Bannock, Montana, located in Beaverhead County. Found in 1862 and abandoned in 1954. And it was the rush started to taper off in California and Colorado. Prospectors flocked to Montana. New discoveries were being unearthed every day. Towns rose and prospered for brief periods, and because it was the Wild West, crime always seemed to follow. Bannock became famous as a lawless town in a dangerous region. While the gold was being mined and the money was flowing, organized crime prospered. Things took a notorious turn in January of 1863 when Henry Plummer arrived. He was a prospector with a dubious reputation who settled in Bannock after meeting his future wife on his way from Washington to Maine. Well, shortly after he arrived, he killed a man in a crowded saloon. Witnesses concluded it was self-defense, and the incident made Plummer popular in the mining town. In fact, he was so popular, just a few months after he was elected sheriff. Well, that was a mistake, because Plummer became the leader of a large gang of road agents. That's highwaymen who robbed and murdered prospectors as they were transporting their gold. His group became known as the Innocents, including more than 100 people. Because of his contacts, he knew when and where gold was being transferred. And it didn't take long for residents to grow suspicious for some of Plummer's men to turn on him. Eventually arrested in January 1864 by the newly formed Montana Vigilantes. And he was shortly thereafter hung for his crimes. Well, by the summer of 1864, Bannock's mines were petering out. With gold being discovered in other parts of the territory, miners began to move away in the early 1900s. The process of lode mining revived the town briefly. Kept it alive until World War II, as a matter of fact. But by 1953, Bannock was just one resident, had just one resident, C.W. Stallings, who owned and operated an ore processing mill. In fact, he bought what was left of the abandoned town from the bankrupt mining companies and sold it to a group that wanted to save Bannock's history. Sold it for $1,000. Result of the sale, and the state of Montana declaring it a national park in 1954, Bannock is well preserved. More than 50 buildings remain, including the red brick Hotel Mead that was once the Beaverhead County Courthouse. And in those old buildings, especially if you know how to use a metal detector, no telling what you're going to find. Well, let's go to our next abandoned place, Terlinga, Texas. The mining town at Chicago Industrial's Howard Perry lifted up and eventually destroyed. It's located in Brewster County, Texas, founded in 1888 and abandoned in 1945. The founding of this town had actually preceded the arrival of Perry. Established in the 1880s when cinnabar, a red brick form of mercury, was discovered. It brought miners to the area and attracted Perry, who had acquired four sections of Texas land. Likely, he claimed it as a collateral for an unpaid debt. Founded the Cecil's Mining Company that extracted the cinnabar and became one of the nation's leading producers of quicksilver. With the company in town located about 12 miles from the Mexican border, he operated his business with laborers from Mexico. He paid them low wages, which allowed Perry, who lived in Chicago, to reap enormous financial rewards. His wealth grew as the demand for quicksilver exploded with the outbreak of World War I. He built a town and a community that grew to something of more than 2,000 people. His company owned a commissary, a hotel, a school, a hospital, and a theater that included phone and water service. In one section of town, he built beautiful homes for white workers, built smaller homes, provided rent-free for laborers from Mexico, and also built a mansion for himself. Oh no, he didn't skimp on what he wanted. But like many wealthy entrepreneurs of the day, he overreached. 1930, he was forced to settle a dispute with the owners of a rival mine for $75,000 when it was discovered one of his mine shafts extended 200 feet into their territory. He also came under fire for paying low wages to his Mexican laborers and for unsafe working conditions in his mines. They were dangerously hot and there was little ventilation. Eventually, cinnabar and quicksilver demand slowed after World War I came to an end. Perry's mines were virtually tapped out anyway. He continued to try to expand his business in his search for more wealth, but only sank further into debt. Eventually, in 1942, he went bankrupt, died about 2 years later. What he left behind was a poor town trying to survive off a dying industry. At least in his 2020, there were 78 residents in the area surrounding Terlinga. Tourists are lured by such outdoor pursuits as biking and skiing, and there's even a chili cook-off every November. And that cook-off attracts about 10,000 people. Visitors to Terlinga can still tour the ruins of the mining company in downtown, a mix of the old west and refurbished buildings with modern touches, such as indoor plumbing. Well, from Terlinga, let's go to Bodie, California, located in Mono County. Founded in 1859. Abandoned in 1942. Well, many folks believe Bodie was cursed from the start. 1859, William S. Bodie discovered a small amount of gold 50 miles south of Lake Tahoe along the Nevada border. And it wasn't much, but it was more than enough to draw miners from around the area and for our community to grow up. Bodie never saw the town it was named after him. Died in a blizzard in November of 1859 while traveling out to away from it to get supplies. That should have been the first warning that there might be a Bodie curse. Town grew and the Bunker Hill Mine was established in 1861. It only had 20 miners at first, but for most of the next two decades it was fairly insignificant. Well, that changed once the mines and mills were sold in 1877. It became the standard mining. Standard Mining Company. A few months later, a rich vein of gold ore was discovered, and that sparked a boom. Standard Mine produced about $15 million in gold over the next 25 years. And the town grew in population from about 10,000 to about 10,000 by 1879, but Bodie had troubles. Winter of 1878 was so brutal that hundreds died from the elements or disease, and an explosion at the mine caused the falling timber. Caused by falling timber, killed even more folks. And, frankly, the town had a less than stellar reputation. Of the 2,000 buildings in the Bodie circa 1879, there were 30 gold mines and more than 60 saloons, as well as an array of brothels and gambling halls. Every little other building along the mile-long main street was a bar, and three breweries landed constantly to keep the alcohol flowing. That helped fuel violence and crime, of course. Murders and robberies and brawls were common. Bodie was known as one of the wildest towns in the Wild West. 1881, Reverend F.M. Warrington described it as a sea of sin lashed by the tempest of lust and passion. Still, the town survived, even as its population dwindled by two-thirds after many miners moved on to other boom towns with more productive claims. And then came the fires. One in 1892 destroyed much of the business district. 6 years later, another fire destroyed the mill. Well, both were rebuilt, and the town continued on until 1932, when a two-and-a-half-year-old boy playing with matches started another fire that destroyed nearly 95% of the buildings in Bodie. Well, by that point in time, there were only six residents left in town. Five were either murdered or died by strange diseases, punctuating the legacy of a town that officially shut down after World War II and remained neglected until it became a California historical site in 1962. Legend of the Bodie curse remains, though. Visitors often report having seen ghosts and are given notice if they remove anything, even a rock, they'll suffer bad luck. So is the curse real or just a way to stop theft. Well, that's a question that's difficult to answer. But park rangers reported to keep a logbook of things that had been returned by people who didn't heed the warnings and took things home with them. Certainly it is possible it is a curse. Well, let's go to southern New Jersey. The New Jersey Pine Barrens. Founded in 1688 and abandoned in 1869. And if you're a fan of The Sopranos, you'll recognize this region as a good place for a murderous crime family to bury bodies. And it's not that far from several busy cities, but it's still rural, remote, and mostly unbothered by the elements, or by humans for that matter. Much different in the 17th century when Europeans settled in that area, nestled on the shore of the Atlantic coast, just east of what would become Philadelphia. The forest was perfect for shipbuilding operations in the late 1600s. Sawmills and grist mills soon followed. The area eventually became a hotbed of iron and ironwork as well. In fact, iron furnaces in the region provided essential munitions for the military in both the American Revolution and the War of 1812. Cities grew up around it, including Camden and Atlantic City. The Pine Barrens continued to thrive into the mid-1800s. Cotton mills and glass factories opened, and the railroad came through, connecting a series of towns into a mini-metropolis. But when the bog iron industry left in 1869, other businesses and most of the people began to abandon the town that was in the Pine Barrens, gravitating toward more lively and profitable cities. The people who stayed behind, referred to as the Pineys, were looked down on by outsiders. Even as the surrounding areas grew, the Pine Barrens didn't. The region and its early settlements remained largely untouched and wasn't put to other uses because of its sandy, acidic soil, which was deemed bad for farming. What remained was a large natural forest tucked within rapidly evolving New Jersey. Today, buried deep in the rows of pine trees are a series of ghost towns from the industrial days. Some of the ruins are relatively well preserved, others are slowly being overtaken by nature. There's about two villages, once an iron and glassmaking center, which has 33 structures still standing, including a mansion, a sawmill, and a general store. There's the ironworks village of Etzen, where several buildings remain. There are the ruins of Harrisville, including a once bustling paper mill, now fenced off because it's falling apart. As for its inhabitants, most famous is the Jersey Devil. A mythical flying creature dating back to the 1700s is said to be the unwanted 13th child of Pine Barrens residents Mother Leeds. Supposedly, the Jersey Devil protects the forest. People venture in, swear they sometimes hear it scream as it flies overhead. Well, there are places to explore even in the largest cities. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. The Buffalo Central Terminal, opened in 1929 and abandoned in 1979. You know, when the city is growing into an industrial mecca, Central Terminal is considered a jewel of the skyline. When times got tough in the 1970s and 80s, it was a symbol of the city's decline. Today, Central Terminal is on its way to becoming a key part of an ongoing Buffalo Renaissance. Central Terminal consists of several buildings. The most iconic is a 17-story Art Deco tower with a clock between the 11th and 12th stories. In its heyday, the terminal had 14 busy train platforms and a variety of restaurants and stores that catered to people traveling to and from the city. When the station opened June 22, 1929, the future seemed limitless. 4 months later, the stock market crash set off the Great Depression. A combination of the economic collapse and the rise of automobiles left the sprawling facility with a bit of a problem. Didn't have enough train traffic to justify a terminal so large and expensive to run. So usage declined steadily, and by the time Amtrak took possession of the station in the 1970s, only 4 trains were stopping there regularly. At 4:10 a.m., October 28, 1979, the last train left Buffalo Central Terminal. Amtrak replaced it with a smaller station about 10 miles away. So what was left was a beautiful facility in search of a new purpose. For a brief time, it was owned by a developer named Anthony Fiddley. Lived in an apartment in the building and planned to turn the rest of it into a 150-room hotel and office complex. But he couldn't find investors and eventually went bankrupt. Well, as the building began to decay, later owners sold off pieces of it for salvage. The abandoned terminal became an easy target for vandals. In 1997, the Preservation Coalition of Erie County bought it for $1 and thought they had overpaid. Today, with the help of $61 million from New York State, an extensive restoration project is underway. Goals to reopen the historic concourse were limited to use by 2025, with future plans for housing, manufacturing, and office space. Knowing New York State, in all likelihood, to be turned into a camp for migrants. On that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow and talk about some other interesting places to go explore. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.